Hey everybody, welcome to the 440 Guitar Podcast. I'm your host today, Jarrell Powell. Thank you so much for tuning up. You can catch the podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anchor.fm/440. Be sure to follow the podcast as well on Instagram at the 440 Guitar Podcast to get updates on episodes coming out, checking out our videos and whatnot as well, to slowly grow that fan base. So feel free to do that. And then also, I always want to be sure to continue to grow the community and also to give a spotlight to artists that you think should be on the 440 Guitar Podcast that I should be able to speak to. So if you've been formally on the show, or if you know someone where, hey, this guitarist is great, I think he should really get a spotlight, I think Jarrell would be a great person to interview for him, feel free to send me a message via Instagram at the 440 Guitar Podcast, or you can just email me. You can go to the 440podcast@gmail.com. So you're more than welcome to do that if you would like to do so. So of course you are more than welcome. Today is a very different episode. We are changing strings, if you will, on the 440 Guitar Podcast. And this is an episode that I'm very excited to speak with this artist. I wanted to give a little bit of a descriptor. So for this artist, they have a, this is described as Greece's dark progressive alt pop. There's a new album that's her fourth album that's going to be coming out April 1st, titled The Missing Fourth Guest. Very excited to speak with this artist who also, just another descriptor, has a background for classical music training. Songwriting is constrived within a pop yet progressive glitch, jazz fragment, cinematic, orchestral, electronic, industrial noises, and just many other things that can just be captivating for the human ear. The 440 Guitar Podcast is excited to have Leah Hyde on the show. How are you?
I'm fine. What an introduction. Wow. Thank you.
Oh, of course. Of course. So how is it over there at this current time of day? I know it's a little early, you know, a bit, right? I know we were talking a bit off air as far as some noises coming around.
It's a noisy time of the day. It's 10 a.m. It's early, but it's okay. It's bright. It's almost springtime, although there's been some notifications we might be having snow next week.
Oh.
It's a very weird winter. We get 19 degrees, that's Celsius, and then we go back to zero. So it's very weird.
Wow.
But it's a nice day today. It's very bright and sunny.
Wow. Wow. That's interesting. How often does it snow in Greece?
Well, yeah, I understand people think that Greece is like, you know, Mykonos and sunny beaches and hotels on the beach. It tends to snow pretty often lately. The past 3 or 4 years, we had a very big and, you know, ugly snowstorm a month ago. We had like a meter high snowdrop, continuous snowdrop for 2 days in Athens. It totally paralyzed the city, which is a 5 million city, a 5 million population city. So you can understand it was just disaster.
Wow.
So it tends to snow lately. Talk about climate change. We are almost tropical here. We have abrupt changes, a lot of rain, a lot of snow, and then sunshine and summer vibes throughout the winter. So it's peculiar, to say the least.
Yeah, that's interesting. Wow, I did not know that. Wow. So on the 440 Guitar Podcast, we're really big on origin stories, how people got to where they are today. And just to just go right into it, one of the first questions I tend to like to ask my guests on the show is, tell me about your earliest memory in music.
My earliest first one, just one.
I mean, it could be an assortment of a few things, the first few things.
Well, there was always music around in the house. My dad used to play the guitar in a very, kind of famous band back in the 60s in Athens. And my granddad, he was a blacksmith. He was working in, you know, the very commercial and very touristic place downtown Athens, where you go and buy your souvenirs. So he was working there, and he would always bring in small instruments, or he would play rhythmical sounds in the house. And my mom would sing. So I was always brought up in this very music-friendly environment, a lot of radio, almost no TV. There was a story in our house that the TV would not function after 10 p.m. So we fell for it when we were young, and we wouldn't see any TV after, you know, past 10 p.m. There was no TV, so we just listened to the radio.
Oh, wow.
And I remember I was requested that I have a piano, and I got a guitar instead because it was way cheaper and could fit the apartment. So actually, my first musical training was I took classical guitar lessons.
Oh, wow. 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 Man, that's amazing. So so you said which one of your relatives you said that played guitar in your family?
My dad.
Your dad. So he definitely was a huge inspiration as far as, oh, I want to play that. I want to play that guitar, right?
Well, no, actually, I wanted to play the piano. I don't know where I saw that. I don't know where I saw that instrument, and I was utterly amazed by it. But I always wanted to have a piano in the house.
Oh, wow.
But the guitar was always around. Actually, many guitars. I still have 6 or 7 guitars of my dad's right behind me.
Wow.
My dad's alive, by the way, and well, but he just can't play the guitar anymore. So I have his guitars on my place.
Oh, wow.
He wanted me to play the guitar, so he kind of like forced me into it. We would sing together, and we would play together, and we would jam. And then I got a bit older, and I was ashamed. You know, you don't want to play with your dad when you're a teenager. So there's this funny incident. My dad was an owner of a Hofner, very old and very cherished, and a small acoustic Hofner guitar. And he had told me, you know, you're never to take that guitar out of the house, ever.
Oh, wow.
Whatever you do, you can use any guitar we have in the house, but just don't take that guitar. Because your granddad, he bought that for me, and it's very valuable for me, and you please never touch that guitar. But that was a very lightweight guitar. And when I had to go to school to rehearse with my band, I had either the choice of getting that Hofner or get the 12-string guitar, which was very heavy and very hard to tune. And I mean, really, who wants to tune 12 strings?
Right.
So one day I took that guitar with me and I said, well, he's never going to know, right? Why is he ever going to know that I took the guitar with me? He was away for work. So I took his guitar. We had a rehearsal. And on the way back home, my guitar case and my school bag, they got somehow, I don't know, jammed into the elevator door.
Oh, no.
And I actually jammed the guitar between the elevator room and door. And I, well, you can understand how that goes.
Oh, no.
I smashed the guitar into 2 pieces, totally destroying it. I rang the doorbell. My mom saw me white as a ghost. She said, what is it? I said, I broke Dad's guitar. She said, no, you cannot really did that. He's going to kill you. So I grabbed the neck. I took it out of the case. I could feel the neck. And I said, well, no, I didn't really break it. I probably just squeezed it a bit. The neck is there. The body is there. The guitar must be fine. And my mom said, well, you know, your dad never plays that guitar anyway. He's not going to know. And we'll fix it in the days to come. So my dad comes back from work. And he said, well, how was school? What did you do? Are you rehearsing? I said, yeah, everything's fine. He said, okay, show me what you're doing. Let me get my guitar. I'm going to play the Hofner. You get to play the Yamaha, and we'll play together. Well, Dad, why don't I do some math? Why don't I do some schoolwork? I mean, anything to get me out of that. He said, no. Show me what you're doing. I want to help you. And he reached for that guitar.
Oh.
And he knew what was going on. I think he didn't speak to me for a month. I couldn't lay my eyes on him for no reason. I was just so ashamed. I fixed it. I found a very good technician and he fixed it. And he has it hanging in his room like a relic, like a ghost with no strings on. It's like hanging there in his bedroom to remind me that I should have never gotten that guitar out of the house that day. 20 years ago, but it's still there to remind me that I broke his guitar.
Story. How interesting. Tell me about some of your, I guess some of your influences, growing up as far as some musicians that that you would listen to on the radio or what have you that, are big, people that inspired you musically.
This is a very difficult question. We almost always tend to think that we have like a list of five or six people that we have to say so that people can associate what we do with things they already know and are familiar with. But I've actually listened to very diverse things in music. Like I was listening to not a lot of Greek music because I really don't like most of Greek music that comes around. There's Manos Hadzidakis, though, who some of you might know. And there's this particular album he did with Quincy Jones back in the 70s. And that's a very big influence on me. It's an orchestral work, an amazing production, amazing orchestration. And then I listened to a lot of Ennio Morricone, the Italian film composer. But also a lot of John Williams and then Hans Zimmer and a lot of film music. And then there was, I was growing up in the 90s. So, of course, there was a lot of Metallica and Guns N' Roses and then Nirvana and a lot of Alice in Chains, a lot of, Seattle, because that's where the weird and tough vocals were. But of course, I had a sweet tooth for Kate Bush and Tori Amos, and then Fiona Apple. And I then somewhere along the way, I realized I loved King Crimson and anything that was progressive, like Emerson, Lake and Palmer. And I didn't listen to a lot of soul or dance music. That's one thing that I didn't do. I was very much into R&B during the zeros for some strange reason, but there was no dance thing into me. I don't know why. Although I danced like the silly stuff, like MC Hammer silly stuff, I did that, but never a lot of dance things. I don't know why. Maybe because I was a little chubby when I was young and I was very shy to go and dance and see me move, and I skipped all the groovy stuff.
That makes sense. It's interesting that you talk about composers, being inspired to listen. Because it's funny, I growing up, I also listened to a lot of composers and James Newton Howard and John Williams. It's like if you it's like there's a it's almost like everyone has at least heard something that John Williams has made, right? It's just there's just so much iconic music to that. So that wow, that's really interesting. Was it Were you a big fan of movies and that's and just you really paying attention to the film scores or how did that come about as far as you being interested in the different composers and whatnot that composed for film?
I suppose I'm interested in films as much as, any of us. I used to be, when I was a student, a much more attentive fan of what was going out. There's no time to do that lately. I watch like 10 movies a year, which is a very little amount of movies. I think it was me and my drummer, George, who is playing on everything I've recorded ever in my life. We're friends since we were 14 years old. And we were always listening to film music because he was a very big fan of zombie movies and gore movies and
Ha
So he was very into the Italian school and all these film scores, and we were both very keen into Ennio Morricone, and we kept studying and buying books and reading on what they did and what they didn't do. And then we started listening to those 70s album very, 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 very much. So I think one thing led to another, and I started researching. I went way, way back to the silent era and how things were done. I mean, Potemkin, anything. And then I took a course in film music because I just liked it too much. And I think it's one of my teachers in college, she explained to us what the associative power of music can do in a film. And this is what really fascinated me. The things that music can say that the picture can't. Like you can tell where your movie is just from hearing, let's say, a slide guitar or a military flute, or you can tell which period your music is if you listen to, let's say, a clavecin or a period organ. And that was very fascinating for me, that you get to see images just by listening to sounds. It sounds like a very easy, like a very, yeah, of course you can. But I was very fascinated as a student to learn that this is a power that if you really know how to manipulate, you can take your listeners and travel them and take them to places and times and things you can't show without having a video attached to your music, simply with the sound.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's like it's a completely different film, when you take that music away, it's not even the same emotion, so I completely, I absolutely definitely I'm a movie person too, so definitely when it comes to film score, so important. Do you feel that, having that passion and that understanding, do you feel that that kind of inspired just kind of like how you make music as an artist and how you sing and how you perform as an artist?
I think it's made me a very difficult client to when it comes to mixing our music. I think I'm driving our sound engineers crazy because I'm very fixated about the room and how to describe the room. I mean, we could talk in technical terms and describe reverb, but it's not just the reverb. It's like I'm very, very obsessed with creating weird rooms and weird acoustics and having the feeling, like in this album, I was trying to create a very weird impression that you are in the room with us, but this room has not specific dimensions. It's not too wide, but it's not too intimate, but it's very high ceiling and it's very deep in a way. And I think this is what I got from films and from film music. I'm trying to imprint this impressions into the music by manipulating space with, reverb and delays and all these nice panning effects we get to have with technology.
Wow, that's really interesting. I haven't heard anyone discuss like the sonic reverb of how they want it to feel, and then kind of describing it the way you did, where like I want the listener to be like, I'm in this specific room, and I need the reverb to feel this way. Like me as an artist, I understand that entirely. But probably as the engineer is like, okay, I kind of get it, but what do you
Well,
want me to
yeah, if that's not a tricky question, well, we usually tend to communicate with our sound engineers with examples, right? Like they say, like, bring in an example, and I'll just copy that. But then when you bring in an example, you don't want to copycat that one. You want to research that and take it further. So I had always this, there's this album by Tori Amos. It's from the Choir Girl Hotel, and she's the producer in that album. And she's doing this very weird thing, like her main vocals are right next to your ear. You can almost, scratch her off your back in an annoying kind of way, like, go away, Tori. And then her backing vocals are coming and dancing around the room and then coming front and going back. And suddenly, because that was an album she wrote because she had lost a child, I kind of felt like I was in a very big uterus, like her belly was empty with no child, and I was swirling around that room with liquid in it and with voices whispering in my head. So I had the need, if I get to feel like this, I want to make my listeners feel like this. I
Wow.
want them to be able to experience things, whatever it makes them feel. It's a very personal experience, but I just wanted to be able to manipulate this and create sonic images out of that.
Wow. I love that. That is so interesting. Because it's funny. I think very visually too. And it's probably because of my film background, it's my film brain, but I 100% understand that too, so that's so interesting. Tell me a little bit about, as far as, I guess, for just, since we kind of talked about a little bit, your this current album that's coming out soon that people are looking forward to, The Missing Fourth Guest. Tell me a little bit about that album. Is it as conceptual as I'm assuming it is? Or tell me a little bit about that.
Well, if there is a concept to it, it's that it was all written during the quarantine, obviously, since we're all been stuck in our houses for the past 2 years. The title could be not misleading. The title could be implementing a concept. We were actually forced into a concept because we had the songs. They were all more or less discussing the same idea. We lost friends, we lost family, a lot of good people around us died or suffered greatly from COVID, and we celebrated nothing, birthdays and New Year's Eves and even funerals. They were all dressed in the same manner, us sitting in the dinner table, on our desk, or watching Netflix or anything. So it was more or less about the isolation and us feeling helpless. But then we didn't want to give up and we didn't want to give in. So we started discussing about imprinting what we are thinking into video. We ended up filming our videos in two different hotels, which were, one of them was abandoned and the other one was closed during the lockdown. So when speaking to the director, he said, "Is there a concept behind this? You guys just filming videos in hotels?" And we said, "Well, probably we miss being in hotels because we were touring a lot and now we're stuck at home. So maybe that's an idea." So we started researching a lot on why are we choosing hotels? Why do we feel comfortable in empty hotel lobbies and conference rooms and hotel rooms? And I started going back to the things I've been reading as a teenager. And there's this book. Wow, that's a very big parenthesis, guys. Sorry. So there's this book by Plato that's called Timaeus. It's one of the dialogues that's before Socrates' trials. And in this book, Timaeus and Socrates and some other people are joining in for dinner, for a symposium, for a discussion. So the book opens up and Socrates asks, "So where is the missing fourth guest that was with us yesterday so we can resume our conversation? So from where we had it pending, left, we've had it, waiting upon us." And Timaeus says, "Oh, Socrates, he's not coming in. He's been taken ill." And I said, "Wow, it's COVID. He was being taken ill, and there's a missing fourth guest." So I went into further reading and I researched what the missing fourth guest was about. And there's this scholar who claims that the missing fourth guest might actually be a mathematical standard that if it was applied to a mathematical sequence concerning the string theory, it would be actually a totally different new thing. And if back in the Renaissance, people had investigated that in a different way, the entire Western music would have a totally different sound and new intervals.
Wow.
And that just blew me away.
Whoa.
I said, we have a theme. That's it. Here we are.
Wow. That is really intense. I love how research you do for your projects. You know, like that's really wild. Wow. Can you tell me a little bit as far as just like some of the other experiences you had working on the album?
It was the first album we ever mixed online. It was mixed by Ian Shaw at Warm Fuzz in Key West in Florida. So it was very difficult. We were in Athens, he was in Florida, and we would email each other, and we transfer files, and we would have Zoom meetings, and then we would have the best intentions, and then it wouldn't sound like it was supposed to. It was very difficult because you're not in that room. Yeah. And it's not Friday night, and you just wrap up the mix and you have a glass of wine and say, that's a wrap, folks. Congrats. We make it. No, you get to listen to it again and again. And then it's a week after, and you reopen the mix, and it's back to zero, and you have to restart. And probably you did a minor, tiny little mistake that I did, exporting the files, and that's a different bit rate. And then it creates this weird effect, and you're like, wow, that was an accident. Do we keep it? Do we let it go? So it was a very weird thing, mixing online. And Ian is using Pro Tools. I am using Cubase.
Use Cubase too. I feel like I love Cubase. I feel like more artists need to use Cubase. Everyone I talk to, they use Pro Tools or Logic. I'm like, I love Cubase, but this is a side note.
Which version are you using right now? Because I want to kill people at Steinberg right now.
Well,
the updates. I mean, really, people.
I need to I have Cubase 11. I need to use I'm on Elements. I need to upgrade to Artist, but that's the next step.
Oh, you're on Elements. That's great. I'm on Pro.
Oh,
and,
great.
So the funniest thing happened to, so Cubase users out there, please help. So second month we've been using Cubase. I love Cubase because it's the easiest thing for editing. If you're editing audio, feel free to, you know, yell at me, but Cubase is nothing. So it's so easy when editing WAV files and audio files. And all of a sudden, during the second month of arranging and preparing the files, I lost crossfade. I couldn't crossfade anymore.
Really?
I was going into forums, texting Steinberg, and I was like, I can't crossfade. It's your most valuable thing, your easiest tool. I press the X and nothing happens. So I did all the edits the old way. You know, I would duplicate channels, fade in, fade out. I would be working in the 70s with the tape machine. It would be easier. But we made it. Okay.
Wow. Yeah, that sounds daunting.
Yes.
Man, I'm
going to format that PC and reinstall Cubase, and it's going to fix it. But that was a piece of art there. It really got me going.
Yeah, I bet. Tell me about the writing process of the album. Do you feel like, given, you know, the state of affairs, that it kind of you approach writing the album a different way, as far as the lyrics and whatnot?
I never write the lyrics up front, although I'm trained to. I took my second master's degree was on songwriting. I took a master's degree at Bath Spa University, and was very, very, very enlightening, mind-blowing, and it made me structure my work in a totally different way. But still, I never start with the lyrics. It usually is a sonic idea that comes into my mind. It could be a loop, it could be a sub bass drone, it could be a noise from outside my window. So I have the, I think it was back when I did music technology one, that our teacher made us create loops. He said, go out and sample things and bring them back and do industrial loops out of everything. I'm basically working on that concept still. I am figuring out an idea that I like. I loop it. I probably duplicate it, and then I start jamming on top of it. And working with the boys, Akibase is on bass and George is on drums. So working with the boys and being on lockdown, we were all in the house constantly. We are neighbors. We get to spend a lot of time together. So this was a process where they would also bring in a lot of ideas. I would cook and prepare like a snack or bring in the beer, and they would jam on top of things, and we would record on our phone or our recorders on the, I would press rec on Cubase, and it was all a process of capturing the moment, and then I would sit down and structuralize things and try to figure things out and remove things. It was a very long process because I tend to over-edit things very, very much, down to the final detail. So there's, you save projects and you go like song one, good save one, and then song one, that's the save I want one. And then so I have like song one, don't ever touch that mix 14. So I keep editing. I keep edit until I get to the point that I like it.
That's really neat, interesting. Now I'm curious to see, like, once things start opening up again, as far as like touring for that album or live performances, how that would look. Is when you're performing live, do you kind of have the same or similar intellect as far as like the cinematic nature of it needing to look a certain way as well when it comes to the live performance, because I'm assuming that's a totally different
Yes,
animal
yes.
as well, right?
It's we are very we're very we tend to have a lot of effort put into our videos, and there's a lot of pre-recorded stuff with us anyhow, because there's a lot of orchestral work in there, and you can't bring an orchestra with you. So there's a lot of things that are trying to recreate a very specific space again when it comes to live shows, and we tend to think thoroughly every little tiny detail, the way we dress, if my microphone stand is matching my Nord keyboards, if my I am an SE electronics artist, so I'm very happy because that's a red microphone. It has a red capsule. It matches my Nord keyboards. So I know it sounds funny, but I want it aesthetically to look
Yeah, it's
very,
important.
very neat, very tidy. And if anything goes wrong, like the tiniest detail, I get so much disrupted and I get so even angry at me that I didn't pay attention to that detail, that I need this to be perfect. I need people who come into our shows, it's like they come in the house for dinner. Everything must be clean, tidy, smelling nice, well littered, and I need to cook the best food. I need to have matching plates. So it's like you're coming into my house. I need you to be at home and to experience a very nice night and go away with something that you can remember.
That's a great analogy. Makes perfect sense too. Man. I guess one of the last things to ask you, was there any type was there a song, a specific song on the project that was most memorable to you as far as creating it from start to finish?
But all of them, each of them have a very peculiar story, but let's talk about the most difficult one. So the most difficult song in the album is Niobe, which is Niobe in Greek. Niobe is she was a princess who had many children. She was very beautiful, very powerful, and she was blessed with many children. And there once was a feast for a goddess who it was the mother of goddess Artemis, and Apollo is the god of music. And Niobe said, "Why you go all and worship that goddess? She only has two children, and I have eight. You worship a god because she has only two children, and I produced eight new princes for our kingdom, and you don't worship me." And the Greeks were trying to get away with those myths. The Greeks were slowly trying to get away as the centuries progressed from the gods' domination over the humans' life. So these myths, they all try to tell a story of how the simple human is trying to break free from the godly domination over his fate, and then how the gods might punish them. So there's always like a little ethical story to it. Like, beware, you might break away from the gods, but they might, get back at you and revenge you. So actually, that Niobe was punished because she was rude to the goddess, and all her children were murdered. So, she would know better and never speak bad at the gods. So I was very influenced at that story because, obviously, Niobe wasn't punished because she spoke ill about the gods. It's the people who punished Niobe because she was different. So that story really, really got into me, how a mother would be treated from the society if she's too proud or too privileged. So I wrote this song when I was a student in the UK, and it was the most difficult song to manipulate. It really, really, really busted our heads, both us and Ian, who was mixing it, and we were all driven crazy. At some point, I said, "We are not putting this into the album. Let's just leave it out, and let's just, not deal with this song anymore." So Aki said, "Okay, just be patient, and we'll get through it. We'll make it." It's still, when I listen to it, I know it could have been better, but we got to a point where we said, "Enough. We're driving each other crazy. That's the best we can do, and this is how it's gonna go." So there actually is a song in there where I know we could have done better, but I don't know how could we could have done it.
Seven alone. Make sure to hide them forever. Then she said her beautiful food. Mommy, don't. Mommy, why? Tic-tac-toe. I get that too, and that's hard to even just as a musician, as an artist, like it's hard to one, like, be okay with that being a part of your art. It's like if you paint a picture and that part of the painting, you're like, oh, that made a mistake there. It's like, kind of don't want this to be up in the first place, but everything else looks good and it connects. And so, yeah, that I could see that being a challenging decision for all of you guys. So that's, wow, that's really powerful. Interesting. So the one thing that you said that was interesting to me was that you said that you wrote the song when you were a student. So this is an old song. This is an older song that you wrote a while back, right?
This was the only song that was written 7 years ago. That was my second master's degree. So I went back to school when I was older. So, I got my songwriting degree. I think I graduated in 2007. So it's not that old, but it's old.
Okay. Wow. Yeah, I mean, even what you talked about as far as the process of bringing in samples that you're recording yourself and, and implementing that, into writing, that's such a powerful and interesting exercise, and it makes a lot of sense too. It's I feel like the more I dabble in, play music and everything, it's like, and create music, it's like that makes a lot of sense, especially today in the digital world where we have, now we are in a state where we have people that own licensing to older music that people are sampling for their music, but now they have to pay somebody else, So, I've had those moments where I'm like, I'm just gonna make it myself, so I don't have to pay anybody.
Why not? Why not? But I understand people who use samples, or I understand that kind of music. I even understand people who go and create on ready-made loops. Like there's these loop channels now where you can have a four-chord song. And they even have little anchors on YouTube where you can go to the bridge and you can go to the chorus. And I understand that. I mean, I think that when you get to the creative process, whatever works for you is fine. You should be, though, very careful and not steal people's work because someone, put some really hard work into that. But then again, I am one of those people that I studied classical music later in my life. I wasn't one of those people who went into classical training from a young child. I decided to be a musician when I was 21 years old. So I went into college later, and I realized I was one of those people who said, I used to be one of those people who would say, I don't want to study music because studying music is going to take away from me my raw potential and my true creativity. I was one of those people. And then I realized that there was, I couldn't go further, that I couldn't, there was things in my head. I think that happened when I listened to King Crimson's Red album. And I started reading about the scales, and I started understanding what is it that Robert Fripp does. And I realized that I can't figure this out. And I said, I need to study music. I need to understand. I don't want to be deprived of that knowledge. So maybe I should go back to school. And so I'm trying to say is if people need and feel the need that they need to have more information and they need to expand their knowledge, don't feel bad about it. And no, YouTube videos is not going to teach you everything. It's okay to go to a teacher. It's okay to go back to school. It's okay to admit that you studied music. I understand that it's very hype and it's very nice to say that, I did it all myself. I'm like the Beatles. I don't know how to read music. Okay, but like my viola teacher used to say, if you're not related to Mozart, then you probably can't do that. So if you're not related to John Lennon or Mr., or any one of the Beatles, wouldn't you study music? It's not going to hurt you if you need to know more.
I know, I 100% agree, especially because it also, like you said, as far as it kind of, one, it paints a picture of what they're doing from a technical standpoint, but then it also paints a picture of perspective. This, I always think of like people today still analyzing like John Coltrane's Love Supreme, or trying to understand what Charlie Parker was doing here, or art, what Art Tatum was doing through his chord progressions, and how it was like groundbreaking and like, and before its time, and understanding that. So it's just, I 100% agree, education is so important, and it just makes everything, it makes everything better when it comes to understanding
Yes.
things.
And I agree with both schools of thought. I agree that Ella Fitzgerald learned how to improvise by listening to the brass section and to the saxophones improvising. I understand, but way back then, We didn't have structural educational systems.
Right.
And if you think about it, well, Art Tatum, he went and he really researched things and tried to bring in new ideas. Mm. And if you listen to Quincy Jones's interviews, wow, a lot of studying, or yeah. Oscar Peterson, lot of studying. Okay, Oscar Peterson was a student from way back when he was young. Mm. But then Coltrane, I mean, they took all these information and all this experience and all this development, and then they opened up a new school.
Yeah.
They thought this is something that, you know, students should have this available in their hands.
Yeah.
So I agree. You can jam forever and you can create the next punk scene or the next free jazz scene. And I'm all the way with you. If you feel the need, you're more of an academic soul. Well, you should study and not feel bad about it.
Yeah. 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 Definitely. I guess one of the last things I wanted to ask you is, you know, for this album, is there anything in particular that you want the listener to feel after finishing listening to the album? Was there any kind of intention as far as like I want the listener to go through this journey and to feel this?
That's a very, very interesting question. Thank you, Gerald. Actually, yes. It's my most bold piece of work ever. I am very shy, and I may not look like it, or I come across like shy, but I'm very, very ashamed, because I am always thinking that there's something missing that I could have done, and this could have been perfect, and it's not yet there. So in this album, especially because of the process we went through for that song I mentioned previously, yeah. I let go. I said, I'm as good as it gets by now, and this is going to be what we're putting out there. So what I would want people to feel is we went through a very difficult time. Mm. We may not be able to feel strong right now. Mm. We may think that we lost our potential, that we lost our way. We may think we are deprived because of, you know, apart from the hygiene crisis and the pandemic, there's also an economical crisis in most places of the world still. And there's an ethical crisis. There's a lot of racism. I mean, yeah. I can't even start to count the crimes that are going on right now. Mm. So if you feel like you could have been doing more, and if you feel like you could have been a better individual and a better person for your society and a better person for your family, and you're not there yet, it's okay. Mm. It's okay. I mean, don't crucify yourself.
Yeah.
It's been a very weird time, and not only because of the pandemic, but the pandemic was a good opportunity for us to have some time to think. So it's okay to suck sometimes, and it's okay if you do your best and you don't get any output the way you intended to. So it's okay. So just cherish the journey and feel good about yourself and feel stronger. So if you finish the album and you feel like you went through a cleansing process and now you feel stronger, then I am useful to the humanity as a human being. I did something good.
Yeah.
I'm helping you go through it like I am.
Mm. That's powerful. That's really powerful. Yeah, I like what you said too, as far as, you know, kind of like doing what you can. You know, you can't control everything, but you can at least do what you can, you know. So I think that's really powerful.
It's okay to fail. It's okay to make mistakes.
Yeah.
It's okay to leave things just the way you could before you blow your mind out.
Yeah.
We've lost so many people. I'm still very touched and hurt by losing, you know, Chris Cornell. Yeah. We've lost so many people who were driven way past their boundaries. So it's okay. I mean, take it a little bit easier on yourself and give yourself a little bit more credit, because we need you, each and every one of you. I mean, don't go away. We are good people. We need to stick around. We need to make this place a better place.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Leah Hyde, this has been a phenomenal conversation. I hope you enjoyed it as well. But thank you so much for being on the 440 Guitar Podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, there you have it, folks. This is Jarrell here on the 440 Guitar Podcast. We will jam again soon, and have a good rest of your day. Thank you so much. Thank you.